talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gahan. Tonight's show is on the wonder and mystery of Newgrange, Ireland's world-famous passage tomb built over 5,000 years ago. We'll explore its history, its connections to Irish mythology, as well as its cultural significance. You can email us your thoughts and views, talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. Located in the Boyne Valley in County Meath, Newgrange is a UNESCO World Heritage Site and one of Ireland's greatest treasures. Built over 5,000 years ago, this extraordinary passage tomb stands as a testament to the ingenuity of our ancient ancestors. In tonight's show, we want to uncover its fascinating history, its precise alignment with the Windsor Solstice, and its enduring role in Irish mythology. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Jessica Smith of the School of Archaeology at UCD is the principal investigator of the IRC-funded, now of course Research Ireland-funded project Passage Tomb People. Leontia Lenehan is the supervisor guide at Brúna Boina Visitor Centre with decades of experience guiding visitors through the monument and solstice celebrations. Anthony Murphy is the curator of the Mythical Ireland website and is the author of Newgrange, Monument to Immortality, and he's an expert in Irish mythology and ancient astronomy. While you're all very welcome. And Leontia, I'm going to start with you and the brilliant job that you have in letting the people know that they've won a visit to one of these solstice mornings. Can you tell me about how people enter, what they have to do, and how many get picked?
Well, basically, anybody who visits the monument has the opportunity to complete an application form here on site. Also, you can apply via email. The draw will take place end of September, beginning of October. We select or pull out about 100 applications, and of those, 40 people are invited along with a guest. It's always nice to share the experience with somebody. We also have a reserve list because obviously you may not be able to make it. It's like a big commitment in terms of time, in terms of finance, you know, in terms of emotion. So that's how it works. And indeed, it is a very exciting job to have to write out to the lucky winners and tell them they've been successful. And we just get the most amazing reactions. People are generally so, so excited. Even this year, we invited a woman from South Carolina for the 21st of December. She traveled all the way to be here yesterday. And she made that decision within 1 hour of receiving our email. We just celebrate the winter solstice at Newgrange.
Very good.
But we celebrate winter solstice. We solstice watch, to use that term. We solstice watch over 5 mornings, December 19th to December 23rd.
And Leontia, why do you think it is such an object of fascination for people? Why does it capture the imagination? Why does it get people so excited?
I think because it's a tangible connection with your past. It's a really emotional time inside in the chamber. Like, you stand there in the dark for up to an hour, just waiting, you know, for the sun, and you've nothing else to do except contemplate life.
And the fact that it is such a rare occurrence, the fact that you do have to wait for the solstice, and how much of a factor is the weather in terms of what people can see?
Well, unfortunately, we are weather dependent, as you mentioned. It's what we want is an absence of cloud, because, of course, the sun is always there, but unfortunately, the cloud cover can get in the way. I suppose if you were to average it out, we would probably have about 2 clear solstice mornings each year. Then again, you can just get a bit of a surprise. You might, you know, go into the chamber. There could be complete cloud on the horizon. The next thing, there's a break in the cloud and there's a tease of sunlight in the chamber. So it's just basically dependent on cloud cover, but on average about 2 clear mornings per year.
And Anthony, you've written about this monument to immortality, as you describe it yourself. And it really does capture the imagination of people because it is so ancient, because it is so mysterious, because in a way it is this joining of the world of science with the world of mythology.
Yeah, I think if you look at Newgrange, it's clearly a monument that was built to last. It's clearly a signature of permanence. In a time when, don't forget, the lifespan was very short, people didn't expect to reach 30, actually. Most people died younger than that. And then you compare it to the impermanent landscape, the monumental landscape of Bruna Bonha that was designed, made from timber, and only lasted a short time. And of course, when you approach Newgrange from any discipline, it's full of intrigue and mystery and questions. And Newgrange has a habit, like other monuments, but it's probably the signature monument. It has a habit of, when you ask a question of it, it will perhaps reveal something of an answer, but it'll throw another five questions at you. And so all the time, I think the greatest appeal of Newgrange today is precisely its mystery. And although lots of the questions have been answered by especially the modern sciences of, well, the disciplines around archaeology and genetics in particular, ancient DNA have given us huge insights, I still think there are many, many, many questions.
And what are those questions? What are we still not sure about?
Well, one that rankles with a lot of ordinary people is, why do they call it a tomb? You know, is it a tomb or is it something else? And of course, the answer from archaeology, which is fair enough, is, look, it definitely was a tomb. There's human bones in there. But it is also an astronomical observatory. What is the meaning of the megalithic art? You know, was it designed and built on the command of one individual? Was that individual a very powerful individual in society? Was society organized, unified spiritually? Were they driven, through slavery to construct those enormous monuments? And even simple stuff like, how do you get 5-ton, 10-ton stones from Claverhead to Newgrange? You know, were they brought by boat or were they dragged across the landscape? So many questions.
And Leontia, let's first describe the area to our listeners, because we're not just, you know, tonight's show is on Newgrange, but when we talk about the Bruna Bonha Visitor Centre, we're actually talking about three parts that are all combined forming this UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Oh, absolutely. When the River Boyne leaves the village of Slane, it meanders around and it basically encloses an area of about 10 square kilometres. And within that, you have the bend of the Boyne and you have the three great passage tombs, or as we also call them, cathedrals of the Stone Age. So we've Newgrange, we've Naas, and we've Douse. And oddly enough, Newgrange is possibly the smaller of the three, because if you look at the number of curbstones that are surrounding the base of each, it has the least. It has 97 curbstones.
And why is Newgrange the one that gets all of the attention? That if we were to go around, everyone would know the name of Newgrange, they probably wouldn't be able to name the other two.
They were both excavated in and around the same time, beginning in 1962. I suspect it basically is because of the solstice. Like when Professor Kelly was excavating here, there was always rumours in the valley as to the light shining into the cave, as it would have been known locally, at Christmas time. And he, you know, soon into the excavations, he realised the monument was orientated south of east, 62 degrees south of east. So it was pretty evident it was orientated in the direction of sunrise on the shortest days of the year. And I think that's why it's sort of, you know, it is so important, because it is aligned towards the shortest days of the year. And it very specifically aligned, and that the, you know, you have your roof box, you have your small opening above the doorway that was built specifically for this purpose. So 5,000 years ago, it was engineered in such a way, you know, that the rising sun shone through the roof box and along the floor of the chamber, and so well organised, or so well engineered, that it's still happening today, 5,000 years later.
Jessica, it's brilliant to have you on the show, because this is exactly what you're working on right now. So this is groundbreaking, up-to-the-minute research. So tell me exactly what you're working on.
Well, I suppose the key question, the overarching question for the Passage Tomb People Project, was to examine the social drivers of these monuments, as Leontia and Anthony have articulated, like Newgrange in particular, is just a mind-blowing monument. It looms large in the popular imagination and has done for centuries. But when you kind of step back and try and think about the people that might have contributed to building that monument and what were they doing at that period in time, what did society look like, we actually have few enough strands of evidence for that. So this was a project that was targeting ways to kind of to find more about the type of society, I suppose, that would have erected these large monuments. And part of, I suppose, that wider Atlantic Europe tradition, because Newgrange and Nowth and Douth don't sit in isolation. They're part of a kind of a spread of Passage to monuments that go, along the Atlantic fringe more generally, but there's a particularly closely connected, I suppose, group of monuments across that Irish Sea zone, so spreading across into North Wales, into Anglesey and up into the Orkney Islands. So we know that these are islands and these are communities that are probably very connected by the seaways and the riverways, and they're sharing ideas, they're aware of other monuments. You've got the monument, for example, of Brinkethly Dee over in Anglesey, which has similar solstitial alignments to Newgrange, and again up Mace Howe in the Orkney Islands. So these are communities that know of each other, and they're kind of, I suppose, riffing off each other in a way at that period of time. So I suppose that the central kind of the plank of this is, like, if taken that these are amazing feats of engineering, amazing precision astronomical alignments, what sort of kind of resources were underpinning these? And the fascinating stroke frustrating thing about Newgrange is it's so prominent in our kind of our sense of cultural heritage, but we actually know very little about the details of that monument. And that's partly, or a large part, to do with the fact that was first kind of rediscovered or reopened in 1699.
Yeah, that's a fascinating part of the story. Yeah. The fact that it was effectively lost, for so many years, and to be rediscovered in, really, if you think about a 5,000 year history, being only rediscovered in 1699 is really a very recent part of that longer 5,000 year history.
Totally hiding in plain sight, basically. Now, as Anthony would have mentioned, like, absolutely, there would have been kind of local legends and stories about this mound in the landscape. But it was through, as is normally the case in the Irish countryside, people were starting to disturb the mound for building materials, row building walls, that sort of thing. And it had come to the attention of a travelling antiquarian, Edric Lewid, who was making a tour of the country at the time, that something unusual had been uncovered on the lands in that estate. And we're really, really lucky because he was a scholar, because he had I suppose this practice of recording and noting, and obviously letter writing that period in time was very big. We have first-hand accounts of him basically being shown the passage and into the chamber in the winter of 1699. So he writes letters to his colleagues in Wales describing this, describing the loose stones all around on the ground. Interestingly enough, he doesn't mention any human bones. He says the labourers are giving him kind of conflicting accounts, so he's not sure how much to kind of rely on those. But that's a fabulous kind of document. And I suppose from 1699 into the 18th century and into the 19th century, there's at least 30 antiquarians who are in and out of that monument. Some are more scientifically minded than others. You have groups of people in the late 18th century who are convinced there's treasure there. So they actually dig a tunnel in the back chamber and they break the floor stone. So quite a lot of mayhem in there. And we've got a very interesting account from the 1890s from George Coffey, who's a keeper of antiquities in the then National Museum as it was developing. And he's already calling that a despoiled tumulus in 1892. So he's well aware it's been fairly mucked about with. So it means that when O'Kelly comes in the early 1960s to dig...
That's Professor Michael J. O'Kelly.
Exactly, yep, Professor Michael J. O'Kelly. And I highly recommend his book, his 1982 book. There's so much detail about the monument, but also about him trying to navigate that archive and trying to piece together the disturbance. But anyway, of the human remains that are uncovered in those early excavations in the 60s, there's the remains of the unburnt remains of two individuals and the burnt remains or cremated remains of at least three. And those remains, because in the early 1960s, there's not much interest in human bone as a source of information. It's recorded, professionally, scientifically, but it's kind of put to one side. So my project was in part going back to archives of that sort with archaeological science, with isotope analysis, to see what more information we could extract from those human remains, which at the time weren't thought a source of information. You know,
and has it been possible to do any DNA tests or anything like that on them?
It has. So it's kind of, you have to zoom out and look at kind of the passage tombs. There's about, there's probably about 300 or so passage tombs recorded that we know about in the island of Ireland. So that the most powerful, I suppose, or the most powerful view is to look at all of those kind of assemblages, all of those data kind of in aggregate and kind of see what patterns are emerging. Now, unfortunately, in the Neolithic, and fortunately for archaeologists and scientists, we like to cremate our dead an awful lot of the time. There's a good few bones that are unburnt that seem to be maybe buried, but probably disarticulated, so probably defleshed, probably broken up and placed into these monuments. But an awful lot of cremation. Now, cremation destroys your DNA, destroys any sort of organic component in the bones. So that portion of the human remains will be kind of unavailable for a lot of scientific analysis. However, from the unburned stuff, and it's a smaller proportion, but it is significant, we have been able to successfully, my colleagues in Trinity College Dublin, for example, have successfully extracted DNA from, I think it's about 40 or so, 40 to 50 individuals from kind of the Neolithic period.
It is a fascinating story, Anthony. And even looking at that period between 1699 and 1962, the fact that there was such interest in Newgrange, you had people going wanting to see it, you had people wanting to examine it and to excavate and to explore. You probably had treasure hunters and other people who were there for their own purposes, but a huge interest in it as one of these mysterious discoveries and people intrigued by what they might discover and find.
Well, it's a funny thing because, you know, at Newgrange, you asked why is there such an emphasis on it? And of course, the solstice is a huge thing, but there has been an emphasis on it. So if you look at the mythology that was written down in the Middle Ages, Newgrange is the centerpiece of a lot of the action that happens. It's the place of the Tuatha Dé Danann. It's associated with the chief of the gods, Dagda, and later his son. And that's never forgotten. I mean, even in the 19th century, we have accounts of local people saying, yeah, that's the brew of Angus, you know. That in the local folklore, Angus was still associated with the place, despite the fact that, I don't know at what exact moment it got the name Newgrange, but Newgrange is a name that originates with the Cistercian settlement of the area in the 12th century. So it's almost like, you know, they're coming to the monument and there's a sense that there's something special about it. One of the most fascinating things for me about Newgrange is the fact that, as Jessica said, it was opened in 1699. So it used to be said regularly that Newgrange was lost, you know, rediscovered. The interior of Newgrange is rediscovered. A huge mound of rocks like that doesn't disappear, you know. But the consensus among archaeologists seems to be that interior had been sealed off since about the late Neolithic, early Bronze Age threshold. That means the interior of Newgrange was closed off for 4,000 years. And in the early 60s, at the beginning of the excavations by O'Kelly, you've got people coming there saying, do you know that the sun shines into the chamber? Now, I know some archaeologists have tried to dismiss that by saying, but you can see the sun shining in the doorway up the passage at solstice. But this was very specific information. The sun illuminates the triple spiral in the chamber. So it's almost like the later antiquarians, I think Lloyd takes some credit for probably saving Newgrange from destruction. It's clear that Charles Campbell had absolutely no respect for the superstitions and the traditions about the place. If he had been left to his own devices, he probably would have destroyed the monument to build roads. And it's such an ironic thing that the fate of Newgrange should have been saved by a Welshman from destruction by a Scottish Presbyterian planter.
Edward Lloyd.
Yes, he has an unpronounceable surname, Chlud or Cloyd or something like that. He, I believe, had a vast library, which is something I'm very interested in. I'm just generally interested in books and libraries. He was a very knowledgeable person of the time, probably ahead of his time, and actually produced the first drawings. I think Jessica alluded to that. He produced the first drawings of the interior of Newgrange. Now, when you look at his plan of Newgrange, it's quite simplistic. You know, it's almost like something a 10-year-old would draw. But it's valuable because it's the first. Basically, he's the first human being in there since prehistory. And he's saying he's the first one to not just to see, because Campbell and his laborers were the first ones to see, but he's the first one to see and respect from an antiquarian point of view, and to look and say, this is the stuff that I need to get this down. You know, this is extraordinary. I don't think he would have realized. In fact, I'm pretty sure he wouldn't have realized that he was the first person in there in 4,000 years, or the first person with a pen and paper or pencil and paper, you know.
Leontia, that is a fascinating part of the story. It's not just the 5,000 years ago. It's also the story of people like Edward Lloyd. It's the story of Professor O'Kelly, and the way this was painstakingly restored in that period between 1962 and 1975.
Funny, just what Anthony was talking about there. There's a line we often use on tour, and it's that there are more monuments protected through superstition than by legislation. So I think a lot of people had a certain awe regarding the monument and, you know, what the monument stood for.
Well, tonight we are talking about the monument at Newgrange. We're going to take a quick break now, and when we come back, we'll be looking at it and exploring it from a mythological and astronomical perspective. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about Newgrange and the winter solstice. And of course, it is our final show before Christmas, so we're very much getting into the spirit with this exploration of Newgrange. I'm rejoined by Professor Jessica Smith of the School of Archaeology at UCD, principal investigator of that Research Ireland funded project, Passage Tomb People, Leontia Lenihan, the supervisor guide at Bruna Boyna Visitor Centre, and Anthony Murphy, the author of Newgrange Monument Immortality and the curator of the Mythical Ireland website. Anthony, talk to me about Newgrange from a mythological perspective. What are the different myths surrounding Newgrange, and what do they tell us about its significance to ancient people?
Oh, well, principally Newgrange was associated with the Tuatha De Danann, the pre-Christian pantheon of deities, whose actual origins and sort of time, you know, their place in time is not, I think, very well known by scholars. So the main traditions would be that the monument was owned either by one or two chief deities. So it depends on which myth you read, Elcmar or Dagda. Now, Dagda is the sun god, clearly, because he controls the weather and the harvest. He's called Jergdirk, the red-eyed. And there's a curious thing, really curious thing about the mythology of Newgrange, which is this: the sun plays an important part in this. The mythology links up with the astronomical alignment. So there's in several manuscripts, we call them manuscripts, this stuff was written down in the Middle Ages. We don't know how long it survived orally before that. But you have this theme of a god being displaced by a younger god. Now, in some cases, that's Elcmar, like in Tuachmach Eitain, when, you know, under Dagda's instructions, Angus goes to Newgrange and tells Elcmar to get the hell out of there, that he's taken over. But in one of the myths, it's Angus takes Newgrange from the Dagda. And in that, I'm not the only one who said this, there's others who have mentioned it. In that, we see perhaps an idea of the old sun god who's decaying and dying being replaced at solstice by a new version. And so astronomically, what is Newgrange about? People will say it's about identifying solstice. Well, actually, that's curious, because even if you had clear weather for 2 weeks, by the way, the sun shines into Newgrange for over a month into the chamber, the last day upon which sunlight is able to reach the chambers, the 8th of January, according to a study done during the pandemic by Claire Tuffy and Frank Prendergast and several others. But even if you had clear weather for 2 weeks, The challenge would be, inside Newgrange, can you identify which, when the exact solstice was? And I would say, no, you can't, because the sun literally stands still on the horizon. And we have a story of Dagda and Bowen making love in Newgrange. But in order to do so, they make the sun stand still in the sky, which is exactly what solstice is. It's the standing still of the sun in terms of its horizon location. A person who spends 2 weeks or a month inside Newgrange every morning without reference to the horizon, looking at the light beam, what are they actually going to be able to tell from that? And the principal thing from my point of view is not necessarily the exact day of solstice, but the day upon which the sun has turned back again. That, for me, is the key moment. That is the moment the old god is retreating, the old sun god, and that is the moment at which the new sun god is sort of flexing his muscles. That's where Aengus is saying to his father, you know, it's time to leave now. And that is the moment for an agrarian society wholly dependent upon the weather. That is the moment that infused with such power and magic where they can... I imagine a scene in which the chief astronomer druid, there's probably several people in there, but they're all elite. The king is in there and his chief astronomer and chief druid, and they emerge from the chamber to the, like today, what happens? There's a small amount of people in the chamber witnessing the event. On the day of solstice, there can be up to 1,000 people outside the monument. The king and his druid emerge and announce that the sun has turned. And for a pre-literate or pre-writing, a pre-modern scientific community, I suspect that that moment was supremely important. Just look right now at the length of the day, or the shortness of the day and the length of the night.
So it's a message of hope.
Absolutely. Yes, because if the sun doesn't come back, we starve, yes. Literally.
So now we have the sun coming back, the weather will improve, our crops will grow, and it's like the old idea that the sun, people believing the superstition, the sun wouldn't rise if the king didn't wake up or wasn't alive. Now this is like, it's all tied in, I can bring you that good news.
Yeah, and I suppose the key thing here is, as well as the fact that it's probably more about the turning of the year than identifying. You see, astronomy is predictive. You can predict in advance certain things. The sun follows a pattern. It follows a cycle through the year. The moon follows a much more complex pattern. But for me, it just thinking about that over the last number of years, I've thought about what are you actually seeing in Newgrange if you're in there day after day for several weeks? Are you able to come out and say, this is the solstice? Unlikely, because the light beam's going to do exactly the same thing for at least 3 days.
And is it a coincidence that sometimes when people talk about having had a near-death experience, they have this account of a dark tunnel and then seeing the light? And in a way, if you were to go down Newgrange, in a way you're almost like following in that trajectory.
Well, you've obviously read Newgrange Monument Immortality, because I have a chapter in it about that, about the idea that perhaps, and look, it's speculative, of course it is. This isn't based on evidence, but there is this idea that the tombs were sort of seen as portals. The Shi, they were called, otherworld mounds. They weren't called tombs in the old language. They were called, this word is full of mystery, this word Shi. So it's like maybe in the Neolithic there were people who had powerful near-death experiences, whether they had fallen over and hit their head and become unconscious. I mean, those NDE experiences are much more commonplace now because we've modern hospitals where people are literally resuscitated, having literally died. Perhaps under certain, you know, hallucinogenic altered consciousness states, you know, people had these profound experiences. But one of the most common aspects, in fact, the most commonplace aspect of the near-death experience is going through a dark tunnel or void towards a brilliant light. And I think that's exemplified by Newgrange. And what is Newgrange? A place where they placed bones and where the sun comes in at solstice. And it's like this is a moment imbued with such such imagery and such power where the we could imagine that this the souls of the dead are being drawn out, you know, into the sky realm, you know.
You know, incredible. And Leontia, you're so fortunate to have been able to be there and for so many of these occasions, given your role. And does it take your breath away every single time?
It does, absolutely. Absolutely, it does. What's interesting is just the people's reactions and the excitement. And people, they do get emotional, I have to say. And I mean, some days you could have a completely clear sky and you'll have a glorious sunrise. Like when the light comes in first, it's just like a small sliver of light. And as the sun sort of gains height and strength in the sky, the beam of light will then widen to about 14 centimetres. So it's quite dramatic. And people's faces light up and you can see the roof of the chamber. And you do really get a sense of connecting back with your ancestors. I mean, you're basically continuing the tradition that they started, waiting inside to see sunlight, knowing that once the longest night of the year is over, you know, the days will get longer, the nights will get shorter. And that's it. As Anthony says, it's all about rebirth and we're reborn and we can start celebrating again.
And Leontia, there are all these different dimensions to it. It's the mythology, there's the mystery, but there's also recognising it as this incredible feat of engineering. And I suspect that if you were to try and construct something like that today, even with all the technology we have and all of our advancements, it still would be an incredible task. So the fact that they were able to do it thousands of years ago is really breathtaking as well.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, they must have had, like, you know, engineers, astronomers, architects, etc. And, of course, the very first thing they had to do was to recognise and establish the path of the sunlight and then build a monument around that. Because what's really interesting is Newgrange is actually built on the incline of the hill. So when you're standing outside and you're looking up towards the roof box, which allows the sun to enter, the roof box is about, I don't know, two metres off the ground. But as you make your way along the passage from the entrance into the chamber, you're very gradually walking upward. And by the time you're inside, you're actually standing 2 metres higher than you would have stood outside. So engineered in such a way that the point the sun rises, the point it enters and the point it arrives are perfectly aligned with each other. They started with that. And then, of course, they had to build the chamber. Then they, you know, had to build the cairn around it. And it was an amazing feat of engineering. But even like the bulk of the monument itself is made up of water rolled stones and turf sod. And in order to have the turf or the turves, they literally had to remove or denude about 20 acres of their land. And of course, the land was their main food source apart from the river. So there was a massive investment in every respect in the monument by the people.
Incredible. And Jessica, we can't say for certain to what purpose the tomb was being used for, or Newgrange was being used for, but we can get a sense by looking at the wider context in terms of the evidence that we have about farming and settlement and the types of people who may have been there.
Yeah, I think Anthony makes a really important point about do we call them tombs or what do we call them? I'm much more comfortable with the term monuments because I agree with Anthony. They have a burial function, but it's highly likely that that was their sole thing. So we can't think of them in terms of a crypt or an ossuary, you know, kind of more.
They're not like the pyramids.
No. And we know this because I said there's about 300 or so known or recorded passage tombs in Ireland. There is a vanishingly small proportion of those that have been excavated to modern standards in recent enough time periods that we know we have retrieved all of those deposits. So there's two sites actually that we've been involved in. One is Knock Row in County Kilkenny passage tomb, and the other is Fornox in County Meath. Knock Row was excavated in the early 1990s by a colleague in UCD, and Fornox in the early 1950s by PJ Hartnett from the National Museum. And in both of those instances, we're fairly sure that they retrieved all of the burial deposits. And the really interesting thing is when you look at those two, they're probably the only two intact burial assemblages that we can be sure about across this monument class. A wide range of people, from neonates, from newborns, potentially stillborn infants, all the way up to old people, to adults. So people who would have been considered very, very old in their society, men and women. A range of different kind of health indicators, like healed traumas, broken bones, some pathologies, some congenital conditions. So I think that evidence and the numbers there, it's really interesting. With my colleague Johnny Geber in the University of Edinburgh, who's an osteoarchaeologist, he's quantified the minimum number of individuals in both of those monuments, and it's about 80 or 90 people in both. And that's really interesting because it's telling us that only a proportion of the society, we assume, are their remains have been deposited, selected for whatever reasons, from little, you know, stillborn infants all the way up to adults, have been selected for deposition. And when you look at that, I suppose, zoom out and look at the kind of the diet indicators, or you look at the pottery, for example, that's associated with these communities. They are dairy farmers. So I assume it's cattle, because cattle is kind of optimised for our temperate, wet environment. So these are probably in a predominantly pastoral for kind of farming system with some tillage, some kind of crop agriculture. We know there's early signs of animal traction, so cattle traction. We found pathologies, basically bone wear on the bones of cattle that kind of date to roughly the same period of passage tombs. So we know that they are harnessing animals, cattle, for their power. It's a really interesting link. I don't know if you'd quite call it a correlation, but you have this this bone wear appearing at the time that these passage tomb monuments are erecting. So maybe developing animal traction and maybe oxen is linking into these, enabling these big monuments, which do tend to be on higher elevations and using big stones, as Auntie would have mentioned, that in some cases are pulled from very large distances away.
So it does represent the pinnacle of Neolithic engineering, the fact that they were able to do it with such, you know, limited tools available, without any of the kind of the resources that we have now in terms of astronomy and all of that. So with it shows a remarkable degree of ingenuity, given that they didn't have the advanced technologies that we have.
Oh, I'd say they're very advanced. I'd disagree with that completely. I'd say they're hyper-tuned to their environment. They're a complete kind of equilibrium, or, you know, in relationships with the environment that Anthony's already talked about, you know, the awareness of the sun and the sun cycles. I suppose it's a way that we, I think, probably find quite hard to visualise. We're so set apart from nature and environment, and we're kind of cocooned almost by our technology and our gadgets.
And Anthony, I think the mystery in a way adds to the excitement about it and the interest in it, because if there was a booklet discovered that explained everything, the construction, what everything meant, we probably wouldn't be as intrigued, because there'd be no ground for speculation or for the imagination.
Yeah, I've actually written exactly that. That it's.
I'm sorry for stealing all.
No. It's the mystery of it. I mean, that appeals. I mean, if we knew all the answers exactly, people would move on to the next mysterious thing. It is precisely because it's mysterious. And even there, Jessica's talking about Newgrange and Fornox are separated by about 9 miles or whatever that is, in 13 or 14 kilometres. Newgrange points towards Fornox, although neither is visible from the other. And of course, an immediate question from my point of view is that intentional? Is one linked with the other? But they're two very different monuments, because at Fornox, you've this tiny passage tomb, but when you enter it, it's got an enormous chamber. It's almost three times the floor area of Newgrange. And here's the other big difference. At Newgrange, we don't know how many humans were buried in there because of the disturbances that happened after the monument was open from 1699. But it still has the feeling that it's not much more than that. It looks like an elite monument. And of course, the DNA shows that one of the individuals was the product of a first degree incestuous union, which suggests, you know, some sort of, you know, family dynasty. At Fornox, you have what looks like a very communal monument. You have up to, well, between 60 and 80 people buried. The monument collapsed, it looks like, during the Neolithic, when it was still in use, and they didn't rebuild it. So all of those burials, cremations and interments, whatever the proper terminology is, were sealed in until 1950.
And what about the different astronomical perspectives? When you look at things like the spiral motifs or the half spirals and theories about ideas about how this relates to the sun growing or shrinking and so on.
Leontia will tell you that She and her colleagues at Newgrange have heard probably 1,000 theories as to the meaning of the spiral. The great difficulty with the megalithic art is it's fragrant, what I call its fragrant abstraction. It's almost giving us the two fingers. It's almost saying, you're never going to know what I mean. There's no Rosetta Stone. We've nothing written about those monuments in terms of mythological traditions until the Middle Ages. And as far as I've been able to ascertain, it doesn't look like the megalithic art is described in any way in the mythology, whereas the astronomical alignments, I believe, are actually mentioned. But the spiral, as an indicator of the growth and contraction of the sun from solstice to solstice, is a brilliant single symbol, you know, to describe that movement. Whether you're going clockwise into the middle, so the outer arms representing the sun at summer, the middle arms representing the sun at the equinoxes, and then the interior of the spiral representing the sun when it's forming a low arc across the sky. So it's very, very convenient. Now, a curious thing about Fornax is it points almost due north, a little bit east of north. The sun can't shine in there, and the spiral is almost completely absent from Fornax. And yet, there at Newgrange, in very ostentatious form, on the entrance stone, in the interior, and elsewhere, I mean, they are the triple spirals, the only place in Irish megalithic art where the triple spiral can be found is at Newgrange. But Newgrange, Nowth and Douth, all adorned with spirals.
And is that creating a ceremonial landscape, the fact that they're there and their relationship with each other?
Well, I very much doubt, excuse me for being a little bit facetious, but I very much doubt at the end of building those enormous monuments, commanding the labour of hundreds, I think thousands, to then say, do you know what, come here, you graffiti artist, yeah, you come here, you, the fella with the stones, yeah, come here, just put some squiggles on it just to make it look nice. I very much doubt. I think that there is planning and thinking and meaning behind everything at the Bruna Bonia monuments. So those things aren't doodles. Definitely not. They had meaning. But the meaning is entirely subjective. You bring a meaning to the megalithic art and you go away thinking, yeah, that fits my theories very nicely. But you'll never be able to prove or disprove it.
Indeed. Well, we're going to take another quick break now. When we come back, we'll be continuing our exploration of Newgrange and how you might want to interpret some of the things you find. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history. It's the final show before Christmas and we're continuing our exploration of Newgrange, something that has captivated the imagination for centuries. And I'm delighted to be rejoined by Professor Jessica Smith of UCD, Leon Shalenahan of the Bruna Boyna Visitor Centre, and Anthony Murphy, the author of Newgrange Monument Immortality. Leontia, given that there are so many different ideas, so many different theories, so many different interpretations, how difficult is it to give these tours through the monument when there actually are so many different ways you could tell the story?
Gosh, I'm not quite sure how to answer that. We would focus predominantly on the entrance stone. And as Anthony said, like, you could have 1,000 different interpretations to what the art means. And it may, whatever it means, like, you know, I suppose what I'm trying to say is we can't look at the art through the eyes of somebody who was here 5,000 years ago. It could be completely out of context. The only thing you can say is that the spiral in particular, you will find that symbol worldwide. And the other thing is also, Anthony mentioned there just very briefly about being in an altered state, be it food deprivation, sleep deprivation, whatever. But there's a thing called the endoptic. You'd like see these spirals in your mind eye and stuff like that. And even if you're doodling yourself, like you're from the telephone, you're doodling or something like that, you'll often find that the spiral is the one thing that you will draw. So I think it's a symbol that's very common to ourselves. And the obvious sort of conclusion when you're looking at Newgrange and you're thinking about the fact that the whole idea of being reborn and et cetera, is that, of course, the spiral, like the ultimate sort of interpretation would be life, death and rebirth. And sort of sits quite nicely with the idea of the monument.
Incredible. Jessica, what do you hope to discover in the weeks, months, years ahead with this project? What are the secrets perhaps you hope to be able to uncover or answer?
Yeah, well, Newgrange is both fascinating and really frustrating because there is such a small number of human remains, we assume, surviving to the present day. So I think for me that the big goal would be to put Newgrange in context, recognising that it is one of the kind of mega monuments, one of the mega passage tombs we have. But to look at more detail, I suppose, the makeup of the society, to look at the genetic relationships between these people, but to look at their health, what resources they were kind of tapping into. Would they be terrestrial resources? Would they be aquatic? You know, were they hunting from the land or farming from the land or extracting from the sea as well? I suppose to widen it up and coming back to the idea of elites, and I think probably Anthony and I would disagree slightly on kind of how you interpret that evidence from Newgrange. It's very easy to look back through time, those 5,000 years, see and recognise this amazing monument that has become, that looms larger than life, and to see the results of that single, I think it was a skull fragment that had that marker of incest in their bones, and go, oh, well, there we go, we have our king. But I think that's projecting back our modern concept of what we think or what we assume kind of directed this monument. That finding of incest is the only occurrence across Britain and Ireland. It's very rare on continental Europe as well in the Neolithic. By and large, we know that people avoided that sort of connection. We can't tell if that individual shared that, if that was known, if that was a mark of stigma or if it was a mark of status. So I think that it's really, really important to look at that wider evidence base and to come to our interpretations based on the fact of, you know, other sites, similar evidence. A better idea of the society that person slotted into would be fantastic.
The people who lived and experienced, exactly, Newgrange. Anthony, why has this been such a crusade for you over your life? All the brilliant work you've done, the website Mythical Ireland, the different works. Why has it caught your imagination to such an extent?
My pathway into it was astronomy. I took a big interest in the sky at a very young age. And I was one of those rare young astronomers. Most astronomers would be called armchair astronomers. They read all the books, but they don't like standing around in the cold looking at the stars. I was the opposite. I loved, I spent many hundreds of hours as a child. And that pathway in opened up because when we were young, you know, of course, the excavations were still ongoing. There were so many revelations. Literally every season, at Nowth especially, every season there were new insights. And then as a young journalist, I got an opportunity to interview George Ogan and Helen Roach and see the things that were being found at Newgrange. But then if you'd said to me 25 years ago, you know, you're going to make something of a contribution to all this, I would say no, because I'm not an expert. All the experts are going to do that, you know. But it's an unusual thing. Newgrange and the passage tombs, the astronomically oriented ones, because every passage points to somewhere on the horizon. That doesn't mean they're all astronomically aligned. It's about horizon. It's all about horizon. The Neolithic passage tombs, by and large, occupy hilltop and mountaintop and, you know, even locations. And even in the local landscape, there are those three great monuments of Bruna Bonia are on the highest points of the Bruna Bonia landscape. So, for me, it's about horizon. How much of the horizon are you looking at when you're examining that ancient past? In terms of, you know, and people who specialise, I have said this, I said it at the launch of my Fornox book a few months ago. We, as writers and researchers and people who come to this as non-academics, we stand on the shoulders of giants. These people, what they've been revealing, the archaeologists, the geneticists, the osteospecialists, you know, what they've revealed to us in the past 2 decades alone has been enormous. Short answer is I don't know, except for a friend of mine met me at Newgrange and she said to me, do you know, Anthony, I get the feeling with you that you've lived here before. You seem particularly enthralled and magnetized to the place. And I can't explain it. But again, it all comes back to the same thing. It's the mystery and wonder of it. And it's the connection. It's the feeling that you're connecting with long lost peoples. And it turns out that, you know, this idea that we used to have that they were ancestors. Well, genetically now, I think it's been shown that, no, they're quite diverse. They were a different population of people. We mostly, the Irish people, are descended from the people who came after the Neolithic tombs were built, the Beaker folk. You know, we have our genetic origins in the Bronze Age. So even more so now, you feel like you're connecting across time with a people whose story should have vanished, but who made this remarkable effort to perpetuate themselves, you know?
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our debate tonight. My thanks to Professor Jessica Smith of the School of Archaeology at UCD, that wonderful Research Ireland-funded project, Passage Tomb People, Leontia Lenihan, the supervisor guide at Bruna Boyna Visitor Centre, and Anthony Murphy, the creator of the Mythical Ireland website and the author of Newgrange, Monument to Immortality. Well, that does bring us to the end of our pre-Christmas edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night and Merry Christmas.